Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
One definition over the years of religion has been to bind folk together, binds together, whether you're an Islam follower, whether you're Christian, whatever your kind of religion, it binds folk together and addresses a whole range of issues. Of course, it can open up a whole new way of life as well. And certainly Hare Krishna, the Hare Krishna movement, is something which connects with that. And we're delighted to welcome to the program today somebody who actually spent 20 years as a Hare Krishna monk, and indeed rebelled against his family to do so. We're speaking, of course, of the wonderful Andrew Horn, also known as Arjundas Adhikari. How are you, Andrew? How's life?
Pretty good, thank you. Yes.
Good. Well, let's start off with the tale of how, as we said, at the age of 18, you decided that basically you would oppose your staunchly atheist father's wishes and join the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. What led you to that particular crucial moment?
It's a combination of things, because my father was, of course, Darwinist. He was a very successful scientist. It wasn't so much a rebellion, because we were very close throughout my life, very close. My disposition towards spirituality was really caused quite a commotion from an early age, but it wasn't a rebellion as such. It was just so what I found, I really combined the two, if you like, of an approach to a faith that was that had something of empiricism in it. Within the holy books of India, you have a lot of emphasis on philosophy, even logic. So it was, for me, a sort of a compromise, if you like, for the way to go. I mean, I always wanted to be, I nearly was a Christian, but it's the kind of comprehensiveness of it in terms of it being a faith and being a philosophy was what appealed to me. And I think that that was what really, sealed the deal. Can you see me?
Yes, no, that's fine. It's perfectly okay. We were just sort of changing a few bits and pieces around there. No worries. I mean, a fascinating sort of way in which that's taken you on your own life path, of course, and it echoes something which I'm frequently saying, which is we tend to be spiritual beings on a human journey as opposed to human beings on a spiritual journey, or is it a mixture of both, perhaps?
I think they complement one another. I think it's absolutely. I mean, I couldn't not believe. I think it would take the spring out of my step. I think it's sort of personally an important thing, and the longevity of it as a belief, I think, is a testimony to that. Because I was very young when I became sort of rather committed, and I'm getting old now, but I still have the same kind of attitude. I have the same approach, so it's kind of something that suited me.
And there is, of course, the line that we don't actually really grow old. Time is just an illusion, and we simply become more experientially enhanced, Andrew. So maybe we need to look on that particular aspect, or possibly even chronologically gifted. That's another line I tend to use. Let's just talk about the discipline of being a Hare Krishna monk, because clearly all religions have a certain discipline. We can go back to, in the 20th century, the works of Padre Pio and the rising at 4 a.m. in the morning, the whole notion of chanting. Even now we go to the monks of Pliskerton Abbey. There are a whole range of things there. So 90 minutes of chanting and meditation every morning between 5 a.m. and 6:30. I'm sure there are people who actually say, that's so easy. You know, you should have got up at 4 a.m. Why 5 a.m., etc. But that discipline, did it actually help enhance and embed an appreciation for the mystery and magic of life?
You need some structure, because I think, and also it's, I would say, as anybody will recognize, the mind is your good friend if you work it that way, but it can work against you too. The idea of getting up early was important because it was very, it's a very quiet time. So it's a very, it's an easier time to meditate. But the meditation itself was something that would, if you had, for example, you were going through something that was an issue, you would find a resolution somehow after the meditation. That's just a practical example of the way it seemed to work. But I can't. I don't think you can disassociate discipline from a fruitful life, whether you are a monk or whatever you are. You've got to have some structure because things have to, things need to get done. And I think so. That it's a bit like the army. It was a bit like, and so when you then apply yourself to other things, it came in handy when I became, I directed a theatre company. I was selling to bookshops. But the main thing I did was run an art business for many years after. My next life really was the art business. And that was reasonably successful. I had quite a degree of success with that.
Now, of course, you've adapted and staged numerous classic Indian dramas around the world. You've received acclaim for your translation of the 16th century guru, poet, and philosopher Rupa Goswami's a masterpiece, the Vidajda Madhava. I don't think I've got the pronunciation quite right there, but is that the Vidagda Madhava?
That's good, yes.
Okay, we'll get
That's
there in the end. That's the important thing. Do you feel as though, in terms of the message that's actually there from your own life path, as you say, as you look back in retrospect over your time spent as a Hare Krishna monk, that actually these all fit together, that actually sometimes we don't realize the experiences we're going through. It's not until we actually have some life perspective that we can see how maybe they connected.
definitely connected. I mean, I've never really looked back and said, well, that was a waste of time in any phase of my life. I've always felt that one stage informed the next. I think it was particularly valuable because the East has an awful lot to offer in terms of insights into the human condition. So I benefited a lot from that. And my translation of the Vidagdha Madhava, which is in English a portrait of Lord Sri Krishna, is just that. It's a kind of comprehensive assessment by Rupa Goswami, who's the original author, of Krishna as a person in all his charm, heroism, wit, all his remarkably beautifully reciprocated relationships. And it's part of a theology that's rather unique. It's a very, it's a, how should I put it? It's an individualistic understanding of of God's person, which might sound a bit, unusual to the Western ear, but it's a common idea and has been for thousands of years throughout India. But I think you're right. Yep, we're kind of a summit. We are made up. We are the things that happen to us. I think are for our journey, if you like. It sounds a bit, I'm not mean to be glib, but yeah, it's kind of like that. Yes, definitely. I subscribe to that.
The world is in dire need of peaceful consciousness, shall we say, if not Krishna consciousness. In terms of that, do you feel as though it's growing pains that we're going through, or is it just a case of, as we celebrate the festival of Diwali, we literally are simply children and spiritual infants in the universe?
When you t I think a big prompt for in a keenness about spirituality and getting serious about it counterintuitively is suffering. And I think the world, the chaos in the world, may prompt a more kind of serious introspection because you've got to look at stuff like the greed and so on that seems to be at the bottom of it. And whether or not those values are good values to maintain. The whole idea of Eastern and Krishna conscious values is that we do indeed ultimately own nothing, as per the ideas that will be sort of realistically transpire in the near future if we can believe what's being bandied about in the newspapers. But in fact, we don't own anything. We actually are in the end, we leave it all behind. So what's important is something that lasts, that actually has some endurance, and that's anything truly spiritual, and it's a tangible thing. So I think it's very relevant right now for Diwali. I mean, Diwali means literally dipa, which means a lamp, not a lump, a lamp. And Awali, which means a row of them. So it was always celebrated by this big festival of rows of lights, which was celebrating Ram, who was the hero. We need heroes. We need legends, if you like, even, because they're archetypes which you catharsize your values. You're able to kind of pin things on heroes so that you can follow good examples. It, I mean, I'm not meant to be too traditionalist in that respect, but they are very key to uplifting one's spirit. And so Diwali certainly falls in that category. Ram was an amazing hero. His whole devotion to his family, and then that's why he left and was exiled, and then he triumphed over various evil forces and came back successful with his wife who'd been kidnapped. So it's an uplifting story, and I think those kind of things are very relevant today, because we're kind of everyone's a bit at sea, you know, with values and so on.
And speaking of at sea, I was mindful when you were actually talking about heroes, the importance of Homer's Odyssey and the notion of Joseph Campbell's Hero of a Thousand Faces as well, that slots around that basis. There's lots more we could actually talk about, Andrew, but time as ever is of the essence in many ways, and I appreciate it's just an illusion. But if people are actually wishing to actually access a portrait of Lord Sri Krishna, where can they actually find it?
Well, they're on my website, a portrait to LordSriKrishna.com. And they'd be on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and Blackwell's. It's just literally the last week they've all been uploaded, so they should be available. I think there's a couple of hitches, but within by the end of the week, certainly they're there.
Fantastic. Well, Andrew, it's been awesome connecting with your good self. We've got two final questions for you, and I can appreciate there is the line that questions are a burden for others, answers a prison for oneself, but that's another show from another time in the 1960s. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been good for you?
Yeah, it's been brilliant. I really appreciate you having me on. It's a very rare opportunity to discuss on a very culturally different subject on that will reach a lot of people. So it's been very nice of you to have me on. Thank you.
Well, delighted to connect with your good self. Can we prevail upon you to join us again sometime? Will you come back?
Anytime you like. Yeah.
Andrew Horn, also known as Ajundas Adhikari. Huge thanks indeed, and keep on keeping on.
Happy Diwali.
And so we move on from a Hare Krishna monk and his experiences, of course, with Andrew Horn, to another fascinating author and writer and generally inspiring person. And we're delighted to welcome to the program today somebody who, just looking at her website, says the words, "My life hit rock bottom," while everyone else thought everything was completely fine. Yes, indeed. It's someone who's going to talk about neurodivergency, being a neurodivergent mental illness survivor. We're delighted to welcome Amanda Hess to the program. How are you, Amanda?
Hi, thank you. I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I'm delighted to connect with your good self, and all good. But fascinated in terms of your story, which I think deserves to have a key focus on from this point of view. Again, from your own descriptor on your website, amandahess.ca, we've got the line, "You've always been what people would call overly emotional. I used to get in trouble for it at school and home, etc." And of course, this whole aspect of neurodivergency is something which really we're only beginning to understand, I suspect.
Yeah, I would agree with you. You know, when I really think about how I grew up, you know, going through the school system and just sort of getting through life when I was younger, there was neurodivergence was not a thing, right? Nobody talked about that. And I mean, even when my kids were small, I would say there was like some understanding of ADHD potentially and ASD, like autism spectrum disorder, but not a huge understanding, and certainly not a lot of space for people to be different, you know, to cope differently, to handle things differently.
And yet, of course, we know that diversity leads to strength. There's a whole range of aspects within that. We have multifaceted talents and skills as far as the human race is concerned. Again, share with us how you actually went to work on fixing yourself.
Yeah, well, that's a long journey, but I will try to keep it short. I mean, what I would say is that I did always feel different. You know, I did always feel that it was difficult for me socially, that my emotional processing took longer, that I seemed to have feelings that were more intense than other people. And even I remember being quite small and my mom getting frustrated and angry with me and being, you know, told to get over it and to stop acting that way. And, you know, I learned really early on that it was safer to mask and to people please and to do things so that other people were happy with me. And I knew that just created some safety for me. And that's what I learned to do. And, you know, in school, I was severely bullied. And, you know, when people talk about bullying, I think it gets a little confusing because somebody being mean to you isn't bullying. Bullying is feeling like you're being unsafe going to school. Every day you go to school and arrive and you don't know what kind of abuse you're going to suffer that day. And that happened to me for many years. And so when I graduated from high school, I was an A student. I had learned how to do certain things in my life really well. I could get really good grades. And I knew that that made my parents happy. I rode at the stable that was kitty corner to my school. Horses were amazing. Horses got me. You know, horses were easy. And they are. I still love them. I think they're incredible animals. And it was a gift. It was a true gift that I had that. And I had that experience. And I really did well with adults. Adults always thought I was really, you know, mature and all of the things. But I had this deep need to belong, and I worked really hard to do that. So when I went to university, I self-medicated. I started drinking, you know, not necessarily in the middle of the day, although certainly as a university student, that definitely happened. But more so to fit in. Like I found that, oh, if I go in these, you know, social gatherings, if I drink, I can relax. I don't have that constant voice in my head, and I can just, you know, appear different than how I feel, or I can at least take that down a notch. Not the greatest coping mechanism, don't recommend it. And ultimately, as you get older, as I aged and I got married and then I had my first baby and then I had my second baby, I reached a tipping point where shoving down the emotion and trying to hide it from everybody, including myself, didn't work anymore because it was coming out. And in the most alarming ways, you know, just through experiencing a lot of rage and just this emotional roller coaster that I could not control at all. And I remember when I was walking with my son. We were walking my other son to school. So he was going to preschool. I had a Great Dane at the time. So just picture it, big ass dog. Kid on chest, having had a C-section that went, you know, got really badly infected and it was really tough. And I was just not super healthy. And I'm walking my preschooler to school while my baby is crying in the, you know, little front backpack. And I remember getting to the school and just being like, you know, I don't know if you've ever had this experience where your brain just is so loud. It's just, it's like, I can't do this. I can't do this. That was like what was going on repeat in my brain. And going home, and I just remember taking my son out of the carrier and just like putting him in the bed and just knowing I'm not okay. Like, I'm going to lose it. And called my husband at work. I was like, I'm not good. And I mean, it was not pretty. It was disastrous. And he came home, spoke to a therapist. She told me to go and get antidepressants, which I did. And that was the beginning, I guess, of trying to figure that out. And antidepressants for me, I think at the time were needed. I think that that was the only thing that was going to really help. But what I found is they really numbed me out. And so then I just wasn't getting out of bed and I was like not really functioning. So I went on different antidepressants. A friend of mine recommended going to see a psychiatrist, which I did, who this was like a, I feel it's a gift and a curse, you know, because on one hand, he said, you know, I don't think you're depressed. And so I don't think these antidepressants are working for you because that's not what's going on. And that part was the good part because I came off the antidepressant and I was able to feel more myself. But then he said, you know, I think you have this personality disorder. And he diagnosed me with a personality disorder in that moment in a span of, I don't know, 30 minutes. And then I just had that label and I went and did a lot of therapy after that, group therapy, in-person therapy. It just always felt like the goal was to fix what was wrong with me. But what was wrong with me, this is what he told me when he gave me this diagnosis. He's like, it's incurable. This personality disorder that you have is incurable. You'll always have it. And I was like, what? So imagine it, right? Picture it, like me, two young kids, like trying to figure things out. My mom then subsequently got diagnosed with brain cancer, went through all of that. She passed away. And I just always felt so much shame about being me. And it's not like it went away. You know, my inability to cope with emotions, my inability to emotionally process did not disappear. It was still there. And when I was looking at my life and I was having these big fights with my husband over and over and over, and I could tell it was me, like I would just ramp up and then I'd tip over the edge and freak out, and it would just repeat the pattern over and over. So my husband and I were having that experience, and I ended up finding this marriage coach. She's an online coach. And so I read her website. She said, you know, I coach type A women that are married to type B men, kind of laid it all out. And I saw myself in that. And I decided, you know, what have I got to lose? I mean, I feel like I've tried everything else. And she was the first person that ever told me that she didn't think there was anything wrong with me and that it was normal and that it's okay to have a hard time processing emotion. And there's a way to do it that can work. And that beating myself up and always looking for what was wrong with me was stopping me from being able to really find the solution. So that's a very long answer.
a very fulsome one, and certainly something which I think we appreciate. I mean, from the department of we perhaps learn most what we most need to teach, or a variety of that. You're now, of course, an accomplished certified life and success coach. And the experiences that you've just described surely must have fed into that whole experience and enhanced your work as CEO of Amanda Hess Coaching. I mean, inevitably, having not just walked the walk, but talked the talk, those things presumably coalesce into the success factor. So although it seems as though, in a sense, it was a nightmare journey, and certainly from your description, certainly there were lots of areas there which were very problematic. And indeed, that notion of empowerment was the other message that came to my mind, the sense that actually when we simply respond to people who label us, we're almost giving away our own power to that side of things.
Yeah, that really resonates for me. You know, now in my coaching practice, I coach a lot of different women that will come to me and say, you know, this is what's wrong with me. And they tell it to me like it's a fact. And I always reflect back, that's not a fact though. That's a thought, that's a belief, that's something that maybe somebody shared with you that you decided to take on as your identity. And it's in itself is not a problem, except if it is creating, you know, an emotion or an emotional experience for you that is not allowing you to really live the life you want to be living. That's when it's an issue. Because for me, yeah, I spent a lot of my life feeling like I had to prove that I was good enough to have what I wanted. And I could never prove that. I always felt like I was just always coming up short. And so when I got reframed for me and I could take emotional responsibility is how, you know, I put it. It's amazing, because then you have so much more control. You have more power. You can work with your brain. You can work with your emotions. You know, so many of us, I think what our experience of our emotions is, it feels like they're very out of our control. Like they're just going to show up, and then they're going to take us out. And then what are we going to do? And I used to think that for sure. Now I notice, you know, yeah, do I still have really intense emotions? Of course I do. Because that's my makeup, you know, be it that it's genetic or if that it was, you know, reinforced over the years or trauma, probably it all probably has something to do with it. But I really do love thinking about emotions are messengers. They're telling us how we're receiving our life. They're not wrong. We do need to process them. But we do have the power to create emotion as well. We can do that. That is within everybody's control. And when you start understanding how to use your emotions, you can have such a full experience of your life that is wide awake, but that isn't excruciatingly painful, which is, I think, what we're all afraid of.
Do you feel that here we are in the 21st century and a number of issues have come out, certainly of, I'll be honest, the patriarchy, the aspects that come across with respect to that. Do you feel that women are also looking to find their place in a world in which, on the one hand, they can have everything, but on the other hand, actually, it is a challenge And sometimes, as you said, those little demons of self-doubt can pop up and actually make people feel inadequate, not appropriate, you know, all sorts of things from that point of view. And is that something that actually men can learn from as well in terms of similar kind of challenges?
I think so. You know, when I think about the patriarchy, it's like an interesting thing. Some people really love talking about it. Some people are terrified of it. Some people don't. I thought a lot of times I think people don't understand it. You know, it's the, sort of this feeling of it's anti-man, and that's not true. It's more about just the leaning of society, right? And just the way that it's set up for the gender roles that we have in place. But I think, yes, I think that for women, we've been told this story that we've bought, that we need to do work like men do work to be able to succeed. But then we also need to do our work at home like women do work in order to be approved of. And it feels very difficult because I honestly think it's actually impossible. And for men, I think they have a hard time too. I think it's difficult to, you know, I think it's more difficult for men with emotion because you're not really allowed to explore it or even show it. You know, God forbid you show an emotion that isn't anger, right? Well, because yeah, that's the only one that's allowed.
I suppose there are moments when you have tears of joy in sporting events. That's a permitted line as well. So you know, there are areas there that maybe come across.
Oh my gosh, that's hysterical.
I'm intrigued by the notion of what seems to be really advocating a culture of kindness, which again is something which we hear a great deal about, but sadly don't see it in practice. Certainly when we look at the global situation today, how many challenges could actually be solved, how many wars could be ended if we actually literally were kind to each other and actually took that at its truest sense. Is that something again that you encourage your students to effectively be kind to themselves as well and therefore be kind to others?
Yes. You know, I think that we live in a world where judgment reigns. And so we are always judging. And also I think our brains naturally just judge. That's how our brains work. And it's good to know that my brain is going to judge. It's always judging because that's in survival. You know, it's a survival mechanism. And yet when I'm coaching someone, we're going to go into the two things that I really teach are compassion and curiosity. So compassion, this is probably coming from somewhere, you know, it can be anything. It can be, why am I having a panic attack when I go to drive my car? It can be, why am I losing my marbles on my husband at the end of the day? It can be so many different things, so many different reactions. Why am I scrolling my phone when I know I have a project to work on at work, right? And what the things we tell ourselves are very quick judgments about our character. And that's, you know, it's a multifaceted thing. There's lots of reasons why we do that. How I think about it when I'm coaching somebody is let's allow some compassion here so that we can open up to curiosity. And then a lot of times what I really discover with people is that when we are high achievers, which I find like most podcast listeners, like if you're listening to a personal development podcast, chances are you're a high achiever. You know, it's been my sort of experience, right? But maybe you're looking for like, you know, actual help for something that's going on for you too. But when you're a high achiever, I think that you have, without really trying, had this stress response that's going on in your body and it's happening all the time. So you're in fight, flight, freeze, fawn, fight, flight, freeze, fawn, over and over and over and over. And your body is quite primed for that. So that state feels very natural, although still uncomfortable. And so one of the things that I really work on with my clients a lot is having proactive processes to settle your nervous system. And they're really small. And so for women, they're going to be different than they are for men. And what I notice for women is that we are quite visual. So beautiful things can really help your nervous system. Looking at beauty, like having a beautiful cup, can make a difference. Other things like things you hear, things you smell, like in taking those things and using them, giving yourself those tools to bring down your emotional experience far enough so that you go from, say, maybe you're feeling your emotion at a 10 to like an 8. And once you feel the emotion at an 8, you can start using your logical brain because it is available to you now. And then you can start really looking at, how can I be more compassionate here? How can I open up curiosity and really find out more about what's happening, slow it down? And that is, you know, that is the way that is going to work for everyone. I really do believe that. I think that works for every single person. And you're not wrong. Like, judgment is a big thing. You know, we live in a very polarized society right now. You know, you're either on the right side or you're on the wrong side. There's literally no gray area. And then when I'm coaching my clients, I'm trying to show them that there's this massive gray area that they're not looking at, right? And it translates too. You know, I know for even like marriage is one that it comes up a lot, where I see that, you know, the woman that I'm coaching is really judgmental of her husband. And so the reason why that's going on is because she's so judgmental of herself. And it's fascinating. Like, if you judge others, you judge yourself for sure. So the way you fix it is by turning that off as much as you can. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does indeed. Is this a particularly Western phenomenon? I mean, I'm conscious in terms of cultural aspects here. And clearly we're speaking as two global North individuals in the Western area from that perspective. Is it something that actually, in terms of the developments we've had, both technological and indeed sociological, that actually these are some of the symptoms of a society that actually sometimes has lost its way, and that maybe other cultures, and I'm not really citing any in particular, but other cultures might have actually acknowledged that the importance of, shall we say, something like mindfulness is the body's own way of actually healing and indeed centering itself, as opposed to using the latest pharmaceutical product?
Well, yes, I think that that's a very good, you know, depiction of what is actually going on here, is that we're inundated. First of all, we're inundated with information. You know, a lot of my clients, when I talk to them, I give them the homework of being in silence, because they're never in silence. And they've always got earbuds in, right? They're always listening. They're always consuming. And so we live in a world where consuming is easy. We can, like, you know, you think back to when you were a kid, it was not that easy to consume. There was, for me, like, we lived in the country, we had a TV, but we had no cable, and we had three television stations. None of them were particularly amazing. There was a show on once in a while that you could watch. And otherwise you could read a book, or you were just doing whatever you were doing. So you were sort of forced to create. And now we're not forced to create. Now we don't have to create. And I do see it as it's a bit more difficult, because for, especially I think, neurodivergent humans, we have a strong craving for dopamine. And so you can get it. There is dopamine everywhere now. Like, you do not have to work hard for it. But I like to tell my clients that there's good dopamine, better dopamine, and best dopamine. And I'm like, we want to get into the better and the best, because it's like eating sugar. If you eat sugar, it's going to taste good. You're going to feel good. It's going to be like, oh, so great. You'll have so much energy for a little tiny while, and then you will crash. And it's the same. If you're getting your dopamine from watching TikTok, let's say, it's fun. I love watching TikTok. I am all about, like, the animal videos. They're amazing, but it's just not, it's not sustainable from the standpoint of, if you're really struggling emotionally, we need to get more sustainable nutrition for your well-being, like what you're consuming, but also what you're creating. And that is something that we're not taught. And in fact, I would say even in school, you know, I look at my kids, I have a 16, almost 17-year-old, and I have a 13-year-old. And at school, they're not taught that. Like, you're really in school, you're taught to consume. You know what I mean? Consume and then create, but only create in this one very specific way. And then you get into adulthood and then it's so messed up. You just don't know what to do. And so, yeah, I think in other countries where they're not as westernized, where they don't have the access to all of the things, although that is becoming few and far between, by the way. I mean, more and more so there's more access, right? I do think that we are not being in charge of our own brain. We're not the boss of our brain, and that's a problem. And it's easier to not be the boss of your brain when you've got 100 million things that you could turn on. What do you think?
Well, I'm fascinated in terms of the way in which you're portraying a challenge that we actually have, but also an opportunity, because in a real sense, yes, on the one hand, we are in danger of amusing ourselves to death. But on the other hand, there is this notion that actually, if we actually can take that steering wheel, if you like, or indeed to use the metaphor of a boat, to actually point it in a different direction, the opportunities and the developments can be huge. And presumably, this is something that your clients really benefit from in terms of the bespoke solutions that you provide.
I mean, I love it. I will tell you, I just coached a client. Well, I coached four clients yesterday, and two of my clients, it's always so, you don't always get this because you go through hard times when you're coaching, as you can imagine, like you're getting confronted with things that you don't necessarily want to talk about or look into or be curious about. It's scary. And, but the one client said to me, that she had this really serious thing going on, but she and I had discussed, her going for this walk every morning in this nature area and how she heard my voice in her head. And she's like, this was going on. And then I was like, no, I'm going to go for my walk first. And it's little tiny things that have a massive impact. A lot of times people will come to me, there's two things they'll say. First, they'll be like, what do I do? That's what they want to know. What do I do? And then the second thing they want to know is like, how do I make this work? It's like, okay, so, or how do I make this work in the moment? Like, what do I do when I'm, freaking out? How do I stop myself from freaking out? Or how do I stop myself from shutting down? And I always look at it from the standpoint of, and this is something my coach, like I graduated from a school called the Life Coach School. It's owned by a lady named Brooke Castillo. So a lot of the things that I learned from coaching, I learned from her. And one of the things she teaches is it's the who, not the how. And that's because we really don't know how to do things we've never done before. And just because it works for one person doesn't mean it's going to work for you. So the who, though, is the person you bring to the problem. And I just kind of look at it from the standpoint of when you are trying to build self-care. Self-care is such an overused word that people just go, yeah, I know I need to do self-care, but they're like, it doesn't have any impact. It doesn't mean anything to them. So to me, I hate the word because people misunderstand it, but it is actually self-care, because if you want to feel less depressed, let's say, or you want to reduce your anxiety, the very first thing you need to do is regulate your nervous system. But all of those words sound unreachable. Like, what the hell does that even mean? Right. So for me, I'm looking at what is your nervous system like right now? And how does it feel to be in your body? Like, how does your body feel? And people don't know because we don't spend a lot of time dropping into our body. And I just want to know, what is your body experience? What does anxiety feel like for you? And then once you know, we can start putting in place tiny little things, essential oils on your wrist, take 3 deep breaths. Everybody has time for that. Even though your brain's going to tell you you don't, and it will, it'll tell you you definitely don't have time for that. But it's like little tiny processes. And I like to pick ones that are very pleasurable. So smells that you really love smelling, activities that you really like doing, things that require your whole brain to use, those types of things in self-care. What you'll start to see is, oh, if I just do this one thing every day, it brings me to it from a 10 to a 9. And that is massive. And, drugs help. Drugs are a tool, but drugs are not going to cure this for you ever. That's my thoughts about it.
Amanda, you're obviously a CEO, you're a mother, as we've said, you're a life coach, you develop all the other aspects of, with respect to that. How do you relax these days? Or is it a case of your work is your relaxation?
No, I always say I have a bit of a toxic relationship with my business. That's why I have a business coach. I need that coaching. That's not my relaxed place, although it is my inspired space. It's truly what I love deeply. How do I relax? That's a good question. I have lots of things that I do to help my nervous system. So, you know, I teach spin. That's just for me, just for fun. I figure skate, which I decided to start back up to into in adulthood. Those aren't necessarily relaxation, though, but they are something that really helps my brain relax. So while I'm not like sitting and relaxing, my brain gets to relax when I do those things. And so that's part of it for me. I have a very busy brain, as I'm sure most neurodivergent people do. So I don't get in a panic if my brain won't relax. But one thing that really does help me, in all honesty, is getting out into nature. And I'm so blessed. I live in an area of Canada called Kamloops. It's in British Columbia. It's a small city in the mountains. And we moved here in 2020 from Calgary, Alberta. So I have trails outside my door and I go out onto the trail. I make sure that I am not listening to a podcast. That's a no for me because it's always like a business podcast if I do. Music sometimes. Lots of times though, getting on that trail and I use my senses. What do I see? What do I smell? What do I hear? What do I taste? What do I feel? Really drinking in the experience of it. To me, that is one of the most relaxing things I can do.
And presumably having moved from Calgary, you don't have any stampedes that wander through on a regular basis.
Yeah, no, I love that you know about the stampede. That's so funny.
Legendary.
I do miss
life.
The stampede. I mean, it's such a fun experience, but I love being in a small city. What I realized is I was born and raised in Calgary, and I lived on an acreage with my parents when I was a teenager, but I really, really love having the trees, being in the forest, having a slower pace. It's better for my nervous system. It's better for me. I'm less reactive, and that's a real benefit for me.
How international do you wish Amanda Hess to spread in terms of, obviously, this is available via Siren Radio, via Southside Broadcasting globally. You've got your own podcast, AmandaHess.ca /blog, Instagram, Facebook, social media, do shrink the world. Is it a case of if a client contacts me from Australia or Aberystwyth, I'm happy to deal with both?
Yeah, you know, I have done calls with people in Australia, New Zealand, all over the UK, Africa. It is global, you know, because I do think this is a human condition. I'm always blown away when I speak to somebody that's on a completely different continent. You know, it's fascinating to me. And when they share with me what is happening for them, and it's always very relatable, you know? So I hope that I can touch the people that are feeling hopeless, you know, because I used to feel that way.
Different continent, but same world. That's perhaps the line to work through. If you could go back to the young Amanda Hess, let's say, I don't know, age 14, age 15, what advice would you actually give her?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I currently have a 16-year-old who's going through a lot of what I went through.
That's why I chose that particular age range.
And it's a bit of a struggle for me, to be honest with you, as a parent. I think what I would say to her is what I try to say to my son, which is that I know this is hard. Build up your own personal practices of things that work for you. Enjoy, try to build the enjoyment of the things you're doing. Allow for the emotions that go on with the way that you're treated at school. It is hard. And it's okay. It's kind of supposed to be hard. As hard as you find it, you'd be surprised to know that there's lots of other kids that are going to school with you right now that feel the same. And I think just learn how to process the emotion, sit with the emotion, you know, get some help, get some therapy. I wish I would have had therapy back then. You know, it would have really helped me. It would have given me an outlet that I didn't have, because I just thought I was stuck with my own thoughts and they were very mean. So I think that had there been some early intervention, perhaps that could have been easier. Yeah.
Perhaps to use the metaphor of Inside Out, we need more joy as opposed to anger and other emotions popping up in our minds, which again, we need to obviously look to impact and so on. Sometimes easier said than done, it has to be said. Amanda, it's been fantastic, as we knew it would be, connecting with your good self today, sharing a variety of aspects and topics and so on. We did say, obviously, the web address for people who wish to follow through is that amandahess.ca, the best place to find more details.
Yeah, if you go to amandahess.ca or if you go to Instagram, you can just look me up. I'm the Amanda Hess. So that's how you can find me there. Those are two really great places to connect with me. You know, I love Instagram. If you come on Instagram, send me a DM. I like to be social there. That's sort of the point. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, two final questions then. Firstly, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today? Has it been okay for you?
Yes, it's been amazing. Thank you so much. I loved it.
Well, the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again? Will you come back sometime in the not too distant future?
I would love that. I would absolutely love that. I love talking to you. This would be so fun. Yeah.
Amanda Hess, CEO and general all-round wonderful soul. Huge thanks and keep on keeping on.
Thank you so much, Alex. I appreciate it.
Getting a good night's sleep, it's almost worth its weight in gold, you might well say. And there does appear to be a concerning trend in society, which focuses on sleep quality. I can't even say the word. Sleep quality, financial stress, mental health, all of these kind of things can worry us and cause us to actually suffer from a lack of sleep. So we're delighted to actually welcome to the program to discuss how we can maybe address this trained psychotherapist extraordinaire, Charlotte Armitage. How are you, Charlotte?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm okay. Well, I mean, I say that, but actually, having looked at some of the figures and the data that we've actually got here, I'm beginning to get a little bit anxious, certainly in terms of places that are most calm or to least calm for me. Obviously, it's great to be in Brighton or Manchester and possibly even Edinburgh. But if you actually go down the list to Nottingham, Cardiff and Belfast, very worrying indeed, it would seem.
It would seem, yes. I mean, the research was conducted by Calm's Herbal Remedies for Calmfulness Week, which is happening next week. And they found that, yeah, I mean, we've managed to sort of rank a number of cities. So we've looked at 17 different cities, ranked them from the most calmful to the least calmful. And the most calmful is Brighton. So there's Brighton, Manchester, Edinburgh, Bristol and Leeds are in the top five. And then the bottom five are Liverpool, Newcastle, Plymouth, Cardiff and Belfast, unfortunately. But 46% of respondents, so we had about 4,000 people responding, suffer from chronic sleep deprivation, which does pose quite serious threats to physical and mental health if this continues. So, but it's not, to be honest, you know, from the research, I'm not so surprised that we see this, because it's certainly in this population of people that were did respond to this research, over half of them are suffering with persistent financial stress, and 44%, so almost half, are experiencing workplace stress. So it does all correlate, doesn't it? You know, if you've got financial stress, workplace stress, and then actually you're struggling with sleep as well. We do struggle to sleep when we're more stressed.
I was interested to see that the age group 18 to 24 grapples with the highest rates of sleep deprivation. I spoke to some of my students about this, and yeah, they tended to agree that, yeah, it was a mixture of, as you said, financial worries, probably stress and anxiety. I was also thinking, do you think the kind of aftermath of COVID could have some impact in terms of people's anxiety levels?
Yes, I do. I think that the world is still readjusting to what we consider a normal pattern of behavior now. We used to sort of have structures for work where we'd get up, we'd be at work, you know, the saying 9 to 5, and that no longer exists. You know, people are working from home, so they might not be working as intensely over a period of time, but they might be working longer hours. And I think there's this change in structure of people wanting to work from home now, which, to be honest, I don't think is a good idea. Not all the time, maybe sometimes, but I think working from home, not having that distance, not having that space between work and home life, is really bad for our mental health. But I would say that one of the biggest contributing factors is device use. You know, I think that's really big, has a really big impact on anxiety levels, especially, you know, it's interesting, really, that 18 to 24 year olds aren't getting enough sleep. I think that they are all using devices too much, which means that they're struggling to switch off. That may be overstimulated by the content that they're seeing, and also the effects of the blue light and the device itself.
And you've got obviously the notion of doom scrolling that we've covered in the past, where you get negative story after negative story after negative story, which I'm sure doesn't have a great effect. Likewise, presumably, spending too much time in gamer environments can also be challenging. I mean, we can say this, of course, Charlotte. We can advise, well, put your devices away and so on. But in terms of actually practically putting thoughts into place, I'm also conscious of the fact that if people start worrying about not getting enough sleep, that can almost become a vicious circle, because they start worrying about not getting enough sleep, and as a result, they get even less sleep because they're worrying about not getting enough sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, yes, that is what happens. There is a vicious cycle with it. And it is about putting a stop into that vicious cycle somewhere, whatever that might be. But normally, if we can't sleep, there's a reason for it. And it's looking for that reason, what's causing this inability to sleep. Now, the basics that we need are, you know, 8 hours sleep, ideally. So between 7 and 9, let's go with eight hours sleep. We need a healthy diet, not too much caffeine. And we do need a healthy level of movement and enough time outdoors. So if we're not getting those things in during the day, then once we throw one of those things off balance, it will affect the other things as well. And then once you're struggling to sleep, like you say, you get into your own vicious cycle of going, you start to think, you go to bed, you worry about sleeping, then you can't, you worry about sleeping, your mind starts to think, then you can't sleep, then you worry, then you can't sleep. You get into, it's awful. But calming the mind away from that, so getting into a really, you know, it's been really interesting having these conversations today, because people have been telling me about different things that they've done to help themselves get to sleep. So one person said that they've got a song that they listen to that now every time they listen to it, they fall asleep because they now associate that with sleep. So people have various different things that they do, but the whole purpose of Calmfulness Week is helping people to distance themselves from the stress that they're feeling in their daily lives, to create some space between your psychological health and well-being and that stress. So there's a space in between. The moment we don't have any space in between to process how we're feeling, and that inevitably presents in different ways in our sleeping patterns. So if we're going to bed stressed and we're worried about things, we haven't had the space to process it, then we are going to struggle to sleep. Whereas if we have the time in the day to relax, to switch our minds off, to think about the things we need to think about, to process those thoughts, then when we go to bed on a night, we're not going to still be struggling with these unresolved difficulties that are playing out in our brains.
I used to use the line that sleep is to human beings what rebooting is to a computer, that actually enables the system to effectively reset itself and actually hopefully resume refreshed in the morning.
Well, you reset and you process. So sleeping is a really good time for the brain to process what's happened in the day. So, you know, for example, if you want to remember something, so if you've got to learn something for whatever it might be, if you read it the night before, then sleep on it, it embeds into the brain a lot easier than if you just read it and try and remember it later that day. So that time of sleep is a time for the brain to process. Yes, it's a recovery as well for the brain and the body, but it's also time for the brain to clear out what's gone on there. So it's a really, really important part. And if we don't get sleeping right, then we're on the back foot for the rest of the day. We make poor choices in terms of our diet. We're going to choose food that
that isn't as healthy for us. We're less likely to be inclined to exercise, to move, to go outdoors and do things. We generally feel more lethargic and lazy. We might be more irritable, which affects our relationships with everybody around us. So it starts to have this quite significant and serious knock-on effect with everything, really.
Which is not a good look for calmfulness week in any way, shape or form. You mentioned, obviously, mindfulness. You mentioned some other sort of strategies that people actually tend to use. I've sometimes found listening to the audiobook version of the Antoine de Saint-Exupéry novel classic, The Little Prince, can quite be quite nice to actually just set me off. Maybe it's because I hanker after a time when life was a little bit simpler. Is it a case that there's a kind of smorgasbord of solutions that ultimately people can try anything from, indeed, just a nice warm glass of milk through to, you know, possibly mindfulness exercises as well?
Yeah, I mean, it is going to be unique to each and every person, but there are lots of we've got lots of advice for people. So if you visit calmsrange.com/calmfulness, that's calmfulness with a K. If you have a look on that website, there's lots of tips and advice, but there isn't a one size fits all. I think what you've just said is really interesting about choosing something that reminds you of a simpler time. And you also talked about a glass of milk as well, which I'd also associate with being younger. And maybe that was a time that felt easier and more comfortable. For others, that may not have been a time that felt easier and more comfortable. So they may want to avoid things that remind them of that. But it is about you finding what works for you and using that. So there are the basics, like we say, staying away from devices, getting outdoors, trying to get into a really good routine, not drinking caffeine late in the day, making sure that you've got enough time alone, to time by yourself is healthy, but also we also equally need time with other people as well. So we need to look at all these factors and how we live our lives and make sure we've got all of those things right first. And if we've got those things right and we're still struggling to sleep, there may be an issue that we need to look at. But I would say if you get all those things right, then I think you sleep okay.
Excellent advice, psychotherapist extraordinaire. I'll add the extraordinaire because I think you are. Charlotte Armitage, many thanks indeed. And happy Calmfulness Week, Charlotte.
And to you too. Enjoy.